Welcome to Dakota Midday on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. I'm Carl Gerke. Coming up on the program, we'll hear about the history of Deadwood's Chinatown and the unsolved murder of a woman purported to be the most beautiful in Deadwood. And we'll talk with retired School of Mines art professor Reve Luckhart. She lives in San Juan Island, Washington, but still holds on to her South Dakota roots. But first, Albert Whitehat, who was instrumental in teaching and preserving the Lakota language, died last week at the age of 74. He was born and raised on the Rosebud Reservation and spoke only Lakota till he started school. He taught at Sinta Gluska University and authored several books on writing and reading Lakota. He translated Dances with Wolves into Lakota for the movie's actors. Wilhelm Mea is executive director of the Language Conservancy and Lakota Language Consortium, and under his leadership, the consortium has become the chief promoter for national action in protecting and preserving the Lakota language. He joins us on the line to help us remember and understand Albert Whitehat's accomplishments. Mr. Mea, thanks so much for taking the time to join us on Dakota Midday.
You're very welcome, Carl. Glad to be here.
How big a loss is Albert Whitehat as an author and teacher, given his work to preserve the Lakota language?
Well, certainly it's a tremendous loss. He was an icon in the language revitalization movement and brought many people to the study and learning of Lakota language through his materials. And of course, he had students at Sinta Gluska on the Rosebud Reservation for over 40 years. So, again, promoting language was a major part of his life's work, and I think that's a major loss for the revitalization movement as it's moving forward.
Were there others who were working to preserve the Lakota language before Albert Whitehat?
Well, certainly there were. I think basically, the language stopped being passed down in the mid-50s, and so a lot of people were becoming very concerned about that in the early 70s, and there was a lot of efforts in the tribal schools to begin teaching Lakota in a more concerted effort through the schools. But by the early 90s, there was still not a lot of success in teaching the language, and I would have to say that it was really something like Dances with Wolves that brought a lot of attention to the language and created the recognition of it as an important world language. And for example, that movie itself brought thousands of people wanting to learn Lakota from all over the world to South Dakota. And from that point forward, there was a lot more recognition of the language and perhaps recognition that it needed to be saved.
Do you know how many people are currently speaking Lakota?
Well, estimates from the past census and other kinds of surveys about 10 years ago put the number at about 6,000. Today, we think it's about closer to 3,000 to 4,000 out of an entire population of about 150,000 across the entire region. So that's a very small number. That's less than, obviously, 1%. And the average speaker age is 70. Plus, and I sometimes imagine it must have when 20 years ago, when Mr. Whitehat was helping translate the Dances with Wolves movie, he probably could never have imagined that one day would come when he might be one of the last speakers of the language. And unfortunately, that seems to be the case. Of course, we're working very hard with the school systems and many other stakeholders to make sure that that does not happen. But, 20 years, slips by very quickly, and suddenly a language that once had a good chance is becoming more and more endangered, and it's become a real danger. In a way, his death is a wake-up call, or should be a wake-up call for all of us. This is one of the few languages left in the United States, Native American languages left in the United States, that have a true chance of surviving. And, of course, it's an important linguistic heritage for the state of South Dakota. So we want to, of course, make sure that it does survive.
Are there many younger people who are speaking Lakota or are learning the language?
There are. Surprisingly, we're finding more and more young people sort of tuning in and turning on to language as an important part of who they want to be as a part of their identity. Right now I'm here on Sitting Bull College in Fort Yates, North Dakota, which is just across the border from South Dakota, and we have an annual summer institute. This is our seventh year, and more young people are here every year. They're learning the language, they're playing in the language, they're acting out things in the language, and, you know, in fact, we have more young people than we do elders sometimes in many of the classes, and they're very excited and very positive. But even, you know, 40, 50 young people won't change the balance. You know, we continue to lose over 100 elders speakers each year, and basically there would need to be over 100 speakers being young speakers producing just to begin, you know, equalizing the loss. So there's still a lot of work to do.
Are there many recordings of Albert Whitehat and others other elders speaking Lakota that can help the younger generations?
Yes, thank God. There have been many recordings of Albert and speakers in his community and other communities. You know, thousands of hours of that, and so. Definitely, those language, the use of that language is sort of preserved for posterity and for future generations as they transcribe those and study those and you know, obviously the hope is to try and maintain the continuity between these last speakers that are passing on, Albert being, you know, the symbol of of them all, and these young people, you know, quickly and urgently trying to learn their language. And so, again, trying to maintain the continuity between these generations is sort of the goal.
Is that part of the problem that, you know, I've heard that some of that there's the older forms of Lakota language plus a newer dialect that may incorporate more slang? Is that the case?
Languages change naturally on the one hand, but of course the influence of English can have a detrimental effect on the way language is spoken. And as fluency decreases between generations, I mean, of course, Albert represents the highest form of speaking Lakota, or represented the highest form of speaking Lakota, and each generation thereafter tended to be slightly less fluent. So to speak to those high levels, of course, is the goal for all these young people. And, you know, I think that just takes a kind of diligent study. And it's certainly possible to have that fluency and to, you know, refrain from the kinds of slang and less grammatical use of the language. But if it's taught well, then we've found that, you know, young people do speak what we call the slow Lakota, or rather the old style Lakota.
Albert Whitehat grew up speaking Lakota. Is that something that is just not happening as much? And is that the best way to preserve a language that you grow up with it?
Well, the language, as I said, stopped being passed down as a first language probably in the mid-50s. Basically, people after the mid-50s tended to speak English as their primary language. And so these days, most of the Lakota speakers are certainly bilingual in Lakota and English, and many speakers are first language English speakers and second language Lakota speakers, and that will probably continue to be the case down through the years ahead. Unless, of course, two second language speakers of Lakota decide to raise their kids once again in Lakota. You know, that's happening here and there and in certain families. But, you know, that, of course, is the way a language can continue to survive, that it's passed down between generations. And so we hope that could happen one day, but that's still a long way off, actually.
What happens to a culture when it loses its language?
Well, you know, language, though, in many people say, well, language is language, and, you know, we sort of take it for granted. We sort of take the fact that we speak English for granted. But, you know, even the founding fathers of the United States recognized the importance of a single national language to create a national identity for the United States. And so, you know, language is sort of the keystone, the cornerstone of an identity. It makes you who you are, and we sort of take it for granted naturally. And when we, you know, wake up in the morning and we start speaking English and everyone shares that same kind of communication method, it binds us. It creates a link that is strong and basically undeniable. And, you know, when a people are forcibly, prevented from speaking their language, you know, when American, when people came to America as immigrants, they basically decided to, forego their heritage language and speak English in coming to this country. And that choice was never given to Native American people. So that left a legacy, of course, and a legacy where they felt like they never had the choice to give up who they were and their language. And so that legacy of not having that language continues to play a role in, an identity crisis. Of course, you often hear about the fact that Lakota people have to live in two worlds, and that's true, but it's even more difficult to live in their Lakota world if Lakota language is not a strong part of that, because language really forms such a crucial part of that identity and creates the kind of self-esteem and confidence needed to solve problems and do all the kinds of things needed, in day-to-day life.
And those are the sorts of things that Albert Whitehat wrote about in his books. And in just a minute or so, we'll hear from Mr. Whitehat in an interview we did a year ago. But in your work with Albert Whitehat, close relationship with you at the Lakota Language Consortium?
Well, I can't say we had a close relationship. Certainly, Albert represented with a separate orthography and perhaps an older style of teaching, and of course, also his students were mostly college students, and the students that the consortium focuses on are early elementary and elementary schools. We work with about 50 to 60 schools across the state, and so there were slightly different approaches and methodologies, but overall, we are all in the same boat, and that is, we're all passionate, and the entire revitalization community is committed and passionate about making sure that the language survives. And so in the end, we support all the things that Albert did in terms of creating awareness and trying to get people interested in the language. You know, he was well known for bringing culture into his language teaching books, and I think that turned on a lot of people to the language.
Well, Mr. Maya, I want to thank you so much for taking the time to join us on Dakota Midday and help us remember and understand Albert Whitehat's work.
Great. Very much. Thank you very much.
That's Wilhelm Maya. He is Executive Director of the Language Conservancy and Lakota Language Consortium. Albert Whitehat died last week at the age of 74. He was dedicated to teaching and preserving the Lakota language he grew up speaking on the Rosebud Reservation. Albert Whitehat was a guest on Dakota Midday last June, almost exactly a year ago. He just published a new book, Life's Journey, Zuya, Oral Teachings from Rosebud, and he said he wrote the book to share the Lakota way of life with both tribal members and others.
I'm hoping that all tribal members who grew up without the knowledge will read this, and our white neighbors in the state will read it so that they will know us in a better light. We have some common interests, concerns, and we need to know each other. And many of our people grew up with a lot of fear of our culture, our spirituality, because they've been through a boarding school system since they were 5 years old. And by the time they're 18, 20 years old, they come out with a lot of fear of our spiritual traditions.
So how did those traditions and practices survive through all those years when they were essentially illegal?
It went underground. Mm-hmm. It was practiced secretly. As an example, they used to have ceremonies in a dark room in closed windows. You don't see lights in it. And the missionary or government agent comes and asks the people, what's going on in there? And somebody will say, oh, they're Lolompi. Lolompi means, they're singing. And the guy listens and hears drum beat and singing. And so, oh, okay, and then they'll leave. So Loampi, in a way, addresses all the ceremonies that we had done in those days.
In your book, you write a lot about the Lakota stories and teachings, and they come from an oral tradition. Are there some things that, however, can't be conveyed in the written word?
It could be conveyed today. You know, we learn better English. There was a communication problem with English language is very difficult language to learn, and I, as a fluent speaker, took me many years to learn the English. I'm still learning. There's some words that I do not understand, but in a way, we can communicate. And always tell people, you know, they use my Lakota language to make me think and believe like one form of religion or another. And I believe I can use the English language to make an English language speaker think like Lakota and behave like Lakota. Languages are powerful tools in how you use it.
How did the Lakota language change, or did it change? Was it altered during those years when, for example, the traditions and rituals were essentially illegal?
The way it changed, it developed what they call subculture. By 1930s, two main subcultures that developed were Catholic versus Episcopal. They're both fluent speakers, but one was strictly Catholic and the other one is Episcopal. And it's very interesting in my research, that keep developing. By 1950s, there was almost a publicly total denial of being Indian or the language. And yet, ones that were out in the outlying communities retained the language, the original form of language. And that's where I grew up, in a rural, a very isolated area, where in the 40s I was a youth, and there's no radios or television, so evenings were storytelling. And that's how we learned to keep our traditions alive.
How hard is it to keep those traditions alive these days?
It's much easier today with that Freedom of Indian Religion Act in 1978. From 1880 to 1978, it was against the law for us to be Indians and to practice our ceremonies. So when that law was passed, it was quite a relief that we could go back to the ceremonies without fear, retaliation, or punishment. And we started going into some of the sites that used to be annual pilgrimage in and around Black Hills. And we don't go in there to own our claim, but we go in there to renew our spiritual strength and reconnection to creation.
What do these traditional Lakota ceremonies and stories have to teach the modern world, not only just Lakota people, but others?
We have a very simple statement of our philosophy. Mitakuye oyase. Mitakuye is my relatives. Oyase means all. That I'm related to all creation. These ceremonies bring us back to that concept that all creation is a relative, and you treat that relative like you would treat your own family, with respect and honor. And this is one way where we try to maintain a safe place, safe environment. Today it's really out of control. It's really sad what was happening around the world with the earth and the water. And those are, to us, those are relatives that have been abused and they're fighting back. So I think we need to reconnect to creation with respect and honor, not so much control and need or wealth.
That's Albert Whitehat speaking on Dakota Midday last June. The Lakota educator and author died last week at the age of 74. You're listening to Dakota Midday on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. I'm Carl Gerke. Coming up after a short break, we'll talk with retired School of Mines art professor Reve Luckhart. She lives in San Juan Island, Washington, but still holds on to her South Dakota roots. And later this hour, we'll hear about the history of Deadwood's Chinatown and the unsolved murder of a woman purported to be the most beautiful in Deadwood.